gets it.
Right, he loves
it. Is.
Good morning. The House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development will come to order on Friday, February 13th. We have a packed agenda with lots of public hearings. Fortunately, several of them are related, so we'll be able to get through them, I think. We're going to get started by opening concurrent public hearings on House Bill 2118, 2569, and 2752. This is our first exposure to the question of several tax credits that might be extended or expanded, and we're going to start with Chris Allenack from the Legislative Revenue Office. Those of us in the Revenue Committee are well familiar and fond of Chris's work. He's going to help us kind of think about these questions, I think, in a general sense. I hope that's not an unfair introduction, but we're glad you're here and eager to hear from you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And a few members, as Chair Reed just mentioned, a few members I think are familiar with this little spiel and the change in process. From very quickly, so you can get to the public hearing part of it, an overview of the tax credit review process. In 2009, sunsets were placed on all tax credits, and then every session, the legislature has basically been going through a third of them in a review process. And so that review process happened in 2011 and 2013. And so this is the third round of them. So after this session, all of the tax credits will have been reviewed at least once. What's new this session is that in 2013, House Bill 2002 required a report to be produced by the Legislative Revenue Office on the tax credits that are sunsetting this biennium. So we released that report last week to the revenue committees. I think it should be available in OLIS as well as on our publications page. And just very briefly, the report contains three sections. There's an introduction to the tax expenditure concept for those who aren't familiar with it. That includes all exemptions, credits, deductions, and so forth. And then there's a brief discussion of the review process that occurred in 2011 and 2013. And then the meat of the report is in Section 3, which goes through every one of these 18 tax credits and provides some discussion of the policy purpose of the tax credit, the description of the mechanics of the credit and the revenue impact, and as well as an attempt at a first step in a policy analysis of that tax credit. One of the key things about that is the policy purpose. For the most part, tax credits do not have a stated policy purpose or goal in statute. So what I did for the report was went back to the implementing legislation and went through the documentation that I was able to find and at least try to glean arguments from the proponents of the tax credit as to why it was in existence and what the legislature hoped to accomplish by offering that tax credit. And this time around, our understanding from leadership is that the real hope is to at least get a very clear policy purpose or statement on the record in one form or another so that the tax credit can be evaluated. Because without that clear policy purpose, it's hard to evaluate whether or not a tax credit achieves that goal or purpose. It's really the first step. Other information included in the report. There's some brief discussion on administrative costs. That part is pretty light in the report, basically just ran out of time. But that is something that we will hope to move forward with in this session. And one of the issues that always comes up with tax credits is what do other states do? So for a lot of the tax credits, try to go through there and find out if they exist in any other states and what those states are doing. So, and try to boil that down into a handful of key characteristics or policy levers that you could consider in modifying the tax credits. Having said that, the Venture Development Fund is a tax credit that actually does have a policy purpose in statute. And so that's included in the report. And I guess the only other thing to add to that is another thing that's different this year is that we have staff time, and that's my time during the session to follow the policy committees and be at your disposal to answer any questions or help you in any way that you would like as you consider the tax credit bills. In the past LRO, we haven't had staff time to do that, to help out in the policy committee. So that's one thing that's different this time. So if you have any questions, we're here to help with that process.
As a veteran of the Revenue Committee, I can say that is a significant advantage for us as we consider whether we want to extend, modify, expand, whatever we want to do as this committee with any of these tax credits. They would then, if we choose to, they would advance to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, which is the combination of the House Revenue Committee and the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, where they're pitted against the other proposals. The questions for Chris, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot 2009. Was there a goal to reduce or to make a savings? And does your report say how many have been sunsetted or how many have been modified?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Wisnett, the goal, I think, a fair statement in 2009 for that bill is a lot of the tax credits did not have sunsets, and those that did, they were on kind of a varying schedule. And within the revenue committees, the issue always came up about tax expenditures, and for different reasons. Some folks were looking to raise revenue. Some folks were looking to just really get at the heart of the policy. And in 2009, at the time, there were about 65 tax credits. And so putting all of those, having the same sunset, would have been too much work. So they were put in three groups with very loosely similar policy objectives. And so this is the third round of that.
And do you have a, Mr. Chair?
Sorry, go ahead, please.
And is there, how many have we modified or how many have we not renewed the sunset?
I can get that information. The report doesn't go into a lot of detail there. There have been, in 11 and 12, there are probably six or eight that have been allowed to sunset. One significant tax credit was divided into four tax credits, because the policy purposes had gotten all enmeshed, but at four, along policy purpose lines, it divided out into four tax credits. One tax credit was actually sunsetted early, and the revenue gain from that was used to pay for a direct spending program that had similar policy objectives. And then some tax credits have just been extended. A kind of a default approach is 6 years, but it's up to the committee to recommend a sunset length. And then some have been modified in one way or another. Some have been means tested. So it really has run the gamut in terms of the policy changes that have occurred.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, thank you. I appreciate this, and it's nice to, I'm new to the body, but it's nice to have this type of communication. One thing that I'm curious about as you go through and you define the purpose of it, that will be very helpful. I'm wondering if there is, down the line, and maybe it's a future question, but will there be an opportunity to find the result, meaning did this tax credit in effect raise revenue as a whole because of the tax credit? Was the tax credit successful, and did it help industry to kind of overall increase commerce and the economies of communities so that we have is there any look at that kind of a more global view?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, I believe that's the ultimate goal for all of these. Is now, all of them don't fit into that category. Some of them will be investment-type tax credits. You're going to hear some of those today. That would fit that kind of review. There are other tax credits that don't necessarily fit that kind of approach. There are tax credits for child care.
Sure,
there are
sure.
tax credits for financial assistance. They have a variety of purposes. So those that fit an economic development objective, the goal would be to get as close as possible down that path to really understanding their impact within the Oregon economy to try and answer those questions. Now, some of those questions are very difficult
sure.
to answer. They're very challenging, but that's kind of the end prize, so to speak, if that's the right term.
Thank you.
Thanks. I expect we'll be calling on you with some regularity in the weeks to come. Thank you for the introduction and for helping us get started.
Sure.
We're open on House Bill 2118, 2569, and 2752. I'd like to note that both House Bill 2118 and 2569 relate to the University Venture Development Fund. And in that spirit, I'd like to call up three people who can tell us about that experience. Andrew Watson, Evan Thomas, and Joseph Janda. If you can please give us an introduction to the issue, and then we have three people who have signed up to testify following you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Thank you, committee, this morning for taking the time to hear about University Venture Development Fund. For the record, I'm Andrew Watson, Director of Technology Transfer at Oregon Health and Science University. I will take a few minutes to tell you a little bit more of the history of the University Venture Development Fund, what has been done with it, with the universities here in the state of Oregon, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues to talk more about it. The University Venture Development Fund plays an important part in the commercialization pathway out of universities here in the state of Oregon. I think there's a figure up here on the screen that gives a schematic of ideas, early discoveries that occur within the universities here in Oregon. Our job in technology transfer, technology commercialization offices within the universities is to move that technology either into one of two places, either existing companies or starting new companies to further develop those early stage ideas into products or services that then enter the marketplace. The UVDF, which is in the blue column, there fills an early funding gap that helps take these early stage discoveries, early stage ideas, invest some more money into those to move them down the point where they can be scaled up through other resources here in the state, such as the Signature Research Centers and other funding mechanisms set up already by the state, and then eventually to commercialization, either out-licensing to an existing company or starting a new venture here in the state of Oregon. The University Venture Development Fund is a unique tax credit program in that it has a payback to the state obligation. So universities in the state that use these funds, deploy these funds, and bring revenue back to the universities, 20% of that is paid back to the state. So that's a unique part of this University Venture Development Fund. To date, this fundraising for this was started by the universities in roughly in 2007, 2008. Funds were raised over the last 6 to 8 years. 26 companies have been formed here in the state of Oregon through use of some of these funds. $500,000 has been paid back to the state so far, but this is a long-term process to get from early-stage university ideas to eventual commercialization and payback to the state. It's on average roughly 8 to 12 years. So our hope is by extending the sunset with a few changes that my colleagues will talk about, we will be able to see further payback to the state. We've used these funds at the universities to not only spur new companies to be formed. Some of these companies, the 26 companies, employ just a few people here in the state. Some employ upwards of 500 people currently in the state. There's also different entrepreneurial education programs that have been set up across the different universities that have been supported by use of some of these funds. So with that, I will introduce Dr. Evan Thomas, who's from Portland State University, who's been a recipient of some of these funds in an entrepreneurial activity that he's been engaged with.
Thanks, Dr. Thomas. Please.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Thank you, committee, for your time this morning. My name is Evan Thomas. I'm a professor in mechanical engineering at Portland State University, where we focus on global health programs. By that, I mean we work to address the fact that today there's still 1 billion people in the world who don't have access to clean water, still, in 2015. There's 2 billion people globally who don't have safe sanitation facilities, and almost half the world's population still uses firewood for their daily energy needs on open cook stoves. And these are the leading causes of illness and death globally. 5 million children a year die from pneumonia caused by indoor air pollution. 5 million children die every year from diarrhea that's associated with dirty water and unsafe sanitation. And there are numerous programs out there designed to address these poverty challenges. There are church groups, Rotary clubs, groups like Engineers Without Borders that go out there on a volunteer basis to do poverty efforts. There's mid-sized organizations like Mercy Corps or Catholic Relief Services. There's the big guys like USAID or UNICEF or the WHO that implement programs like water filters in homes in Africa or sanitation systems in India or cook stoves globally that are supposed to reduce deforestation, reduce indoor air pollution. But many of these programs don't have sustained follow-up. And there are great inefficiencies in the delivery of poverty reduction efforts, so much so that it's estimated that as many as half of water projects that are implemented in developing countries fail just a couple years after they're implemented. So there's great inefficiencies, and the number of people without access to water, sanitation, energy is still very high. What my research group does at Portland State is we try to help improve the accountability through better data collection. We've developed a sensor system at Portland State that we implement on water filters, cook stoves, sanitation systems that are cell phone based. So in Portland, we receive feedback from 15 countries around the world where our sensors are being used to help inform how products are being used, how water filters are performing, how people are behaving, and how we can improve the delivery of those poverty interventions. Our sensor we built at Portland State with students and with engineers, and we started a company called Sweet Sense Inc. That's an Oregon-based company that has customers in 15 countries around the world, including the Gates Foundation, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Mercy Corps, USAID, the UK DFID, all buying our Oregon product and deploying it around the world to help inform their programs. Sweet Sense Inc. was formed by our lab with the help of Portland State University. We have a patent that's co-owned by the university, and the University Venture Development Fund invested in our startup at a critical stage when we were transitioning from receiving grant-based funds to do the development of the technology, but didn't yet have a product that was ready for commercialization. UVDF came in during that valley of death and helped us sustain the technology, move it over to a private company that was able to commercialize and now sell this product. This is an Internet of Things technology. It's a fully integrated data system that we produce entirely in Oregon. The box, the board, all the assembly is produced and the revenue is realized in Oregon. We've created 5 jobs in the past 2 years and realized $500,000 in revenue in 2014. And UVDF was critical to us at that stage where we were no longer receiving grant money but didn't yet have a commercial product. And we hope that you will continue to support UVDF. While we were working with UVDF, we did see that there were some challenges with implementing raising funds through the program. And my colleague Joe Janda will speak to that a bit.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks, Chair Reed and the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Janda. I'm the Director of Innovation and Intellectual Property at Portland State University. It's our technology transfer office. As my colleagues have said, this program has been very helpful to us and critical in getting some of the technologies and innovations that happen in universities out of universities and into the hands of startup companies that can turn them into products and services and jobs in Oregon. As Evan alluded to, there have been some issues in getting donations to this program, and it's mostly structural in how it was originally set up. So mechanically, what happens is donors come to the university and they want to support the program. They're going to get a federal tax deduction for their donation, and they're also going to get the 60% State of Oregon tax credit. But the way it's currently set up, they have to take that 60% Oregon State tax credit over 3 years, 20% a year. That makes it difficult to explain to people. It's created some barriers from getting donations from private individuals. And it's created a lot of barriers for us in getting donations from corporate entities in Oregon who are also eligible for this tax credit. We try to explain to them that they can support this activity and they can get this tax credit, and 60% is great. Companies often don't know what next year is going to look like, let alone 3 years from now. They don't know whether they can take this tax credit or how they're going to budget it or fit it into their plans. To date, all of the universities together, I don't think any of us have gotten a donation to this program from a private entity for this reason. And that brings me to the changes we want to introduce with Representative Williamson's bill to this program. The first is we want to kick the sunset out to 2022 to give this long tail of commercialization more chance to work. The second change we want to introduce is to collapse the three-year tax credit payback to 1 year to make it easier to explain and simpler to implement. And the third thing we'd be asking for is another $15 million authorization in tax credits on top of what's already there. I will say that all the universities in Oregon who are eligible for this are working on this initiative together. And if we're authorized, we'd work together to allocate the tax credits to universities that are being successful in this so we can give everybody room to run with it. And I think with that, we'll take questions. And I thank the chairman again.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Representative Wisden.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The only question I had, you think there'd ever, you're saying there's never been anyone likes the 2020 for 3 years. You think that could it be, you could take, you give, leave it, could we leave it as the option of taking it 60% in 1 year or the 2020?
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representative Wisden. Yeah, you bring up a good point. Yesterday we were in front of the Senate committee and what they recommended to us is putting a carry forward provision in the bill. The original one did not have it, and it was also a little bit confusing. We didn't know whether you could take 2020 and a carry forward if it was always 2020. I think what we'd like to do with an amendment is make sure that it's 1 year with a carry forward so that there could be a 2020 option if folks wanted it.
Any questions? So it seems like that's there's going to be some tension, of course, between this committee and the Joint Tax Credit Committee and all of that as to how we allocate the limited resources we have. If we're at 2020 now and the point is to try to make it easier for people to understand, there may be some negotiations around 60 or something less than 60. Have you thought about those kinds of dimensions and tensions?
Thank you for the question, Chairman. I'm not sure we've thought about that specifically, but I don't see that it would diminish the program any to move off of that 60 number.
Okay, that's helpful. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. We'll hear from some of our public testifiers as well. We may not have had anyone sign up to testify on the University Venture Development Fund. Is there anyone who would like to testify on that bill? None. Okay. We'll come back to that, I suspect. For now, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill. Actually, I guess I need to wait since we've opened them on all three. So we'll move now to House Bill 2752. Victoria, if you could give us a summary on that as we're making the transition from the University Venture Development Fund to the Research and Development Tax Credit, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2752 increases the maximum amount of corporate excise tax credit allowed for qualified research activities, provides for refundability of credit, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2016, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die, and does have a subsequent referral to revenue.
Thank you. We have four people who have signed up to testify, so let's do two pairs. Joel Fisher and Jody Weiser, please. Joel. Jody, so Jeff Newgard, do you want to come on up? And since we have three chairs, the last person is Chris Tobias. Go.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, senior policy analyst at the Oregon Business Association, a statewide organization with about 300 members from Nike to New Seasons, here to testify in support of House Bill 2752. I had an incredible opportunity this summer. I got to tour the state, going to 11 different regions, stopped at about 17 different cities. I think I've been in just about every district in Oregon that's represented here on this committee. And on that tour, I got to spend a lot of time with Pat Scruggs, whom I think testified before your committee just a day or two ago, and is, I think, one of the foremost knowledgeable people on things that we can do on innovation here in Oregon. And we had an interesting conversation where it turned to her saying, you know, I think that one of the most important things that we can do for innovation in Oregon is expanding the R&D tax credit, moving it from $1 million to $2 million. This gets to a strategy that you'll hear a lot more about from Business Oregon today about growing our own here in Oregon. we can do, you know, we can do lots of things to try and get other companies to relocate here, and this bill would perhaps assist in that a little bit, but more importantly, will help companies that are already here in Oregon invest in new technology and new research and grow our own companies. So with that, I urge your support.
Thank you. Who's next?
I'll go. Okay. Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Newgard here with the Smart Growth Coalition. If I could take you back in time just a little bit, in the mid-1980s, Governor Vicatia unveiled a vision for a diversified economy here in Oregon. It was an economy that was no longer predicated on the timber industry. The mission of the Smart Growth Coalition is to continue the legacy that was left behind by Governor Attia. And we do that by advocating for policies that encourage economic opportunity for all businesses and all industries in Oregon. Now, our coalition believes that House Bill 2752 is that next step in continuing Governor Vicatia's vision. Research and development in Oregon has successfully driven billions of dollars in investments throughout the state. However, the credit is often out of reach for small businesses that don't have the tax liability needed in order to claim the credit in the first place. The credit is not capable of being fully utilized by startup companies when they're in such a fragile state. House Bill 2752 is an opportunity for Oregon to make an investment in these small startups by expanding access to the incentive by making the credit refundable for companies that are reporting less than $1 million in Oregon sales. Investors depend on a wide range of available incentives when determining the future of a company, and that's true regardless of whether it's angel investors in a startup or if it's stockholders in a Fortune 500 company. Investments in innovation are critical for the overall economic vitality of the state and recruiting businesses of all industries to make critical investments in research and development can create new employment opportunities for the people of Oregon. The Smart Growth Coalition encourages your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Tobias, and then we'll come back.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, thank you so much for having me here. Just for the record, my name is Chris Tobias. I'm with a little company called GE Healthcare. But I'm primarily here as the chairman of the Technology Association of Oregon's Digital Health Community, which is a new group that is focused on healthcare technologies here in Oregon. We started about 2 years ago, and we have seen incredible interest in growing healthcare technology companies here in Oregon. I'm personally tracking 72 startups or growth companies in this space that are building wearables, that are doing digital stuff. You heard from Dr. Thomas about his data analytics, and I think one of the things you might have noticed as he was talking is that when you're starting a health tech company, you're going to spend the first 2 to 3 years just figuring out how the heck to make that thing work. Take your sensor or your software and test it and test it again. The research tax credit gives us the incentive and the financial power to actually spend money on that. And by the way, thank you for adding the refundability provision, because that means that while you're losing money at the beginning, hopefully you can take that refund and plow it back into the development of the healthcare technology. Over the past 2 years, as I've just talked to startups as well as large companies in the healthcare space, I've seen that healthcare technology is a huge opportunity for Oregon to grow clean, sustainable jobs, and these kinds of investments like 2752 are a big part of that. So I'm here to speak in support of it.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Hayden.
Yeah, just to thank you, Chair Reed. Just for me to put some context on it, when we talk about businesses in innovation and research with revenues of less than $1 million, we are talking about businesses that probably have 10 or less employees or 15 or less employees. What scope are we looking at there?
So the scope of employees that you're looking could really be a wide range, and it depends on what type of R&D you're doing here in the state. I think a good example would be that if you have a company that has $750,000 in Oregon sales, I think it's fair to assume that they might not have a large workforce here in Oregon unless they have an angel investor that's investing, say, $3 or $5 million. But it's all predicated on what type of research and development they're doing. If it's a very small startup that's looking at using 3D printing to try to make a new product, you might only have five or six employees. But if you're trying to develop the next generation circuit breaker, it could be somewhere of 20 or 30 employees.
Just a follow-up comment. So
under kind of what we consider small business, which is 50 employees now, it typically would fall within that category, correct?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, that would be correct.
Okay. Yeah, it seems to me a lot of the businesses we've heard from in the last couple of days would fit in this too, where it's literally a handful of people,
right? Right.
And with lots of potential. Thanks. Any questions? See any? Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it. And as we've
conflict of interest.
Oh, yeah. No conflict of interest, although I am sometimes called Mr. Tobias and they misunderstand my first and last name, so it feels a little weird saying it, but no conflict. That is all the people who have signed up to testify on House Bill 2752. Is there anyone else who would like to? I don't see anyone. So before we close the public hearing on these three bills, I'll just say that since we're only scheduled for public hearing, our initial exposure to these, I think, indicates that there's some work to do. We want to see the revenue impact statements. We want to talk with Chris quite a bit. I think there'll perhaps be some additions, and we'll be back to them, I suspect. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2118, House Bill 2569, House Bill 2752. And we are going to move to public hearing on House Bill 2280. Victoria, please. We're moving fast.
Take your time.
We got coffee. Yeah, absolutely. We're fine.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2280 transfers appropriation of monies in Oregon Growth Fund from Oregon Growth Board to Oregon Business Development Department, authorizes the department to use monies in the fund and Oregon Growth account to pay administrative costs and for purposes related to duties and responsibilities of the Oregon Growth Board, makes director of Oregon Business Development Department a voting member of the Oregon Growth Board, adds additional member at large to board, declares an emergency, is effective on passage, and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. So we heard about the Oregon Growth Board earlier, and our co-chair, Jerry Langler, is back. Please come forward with him. John Finney and Ivo Trummer on our list. He looks surprised.
We're back.
Glad you're back.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for having us back today. On Monday, we were here describing to you what the Oregon Growth Board does, why it exists, what benefits it gives to the state in terms of closing the capital gaps that exist to allow businesses to grow here as part of this whole thing about Grow Our Own. Today we're back to talk about some largely administrative changes to the statute, and I'll leave those to others to talk about, and then one so administrative changes. Sorry, they're really targeted at efficiency of the operation, and then one change that's targeted at effectiveness of the mission. And so I'm going to talk about that briefly. John Finney will get to data to support that request in a moment. One of the elements of the statute that exists today is that when we grant or when we invest money in one of these funds that will in turn then come back and invest in startups in the state, we require a side letter. It is absolutely required that they sign a side letter that says for every dollar we invest in them, they will invest that amount of money in startups in the state. It's a very well-intentioned provision. The problem is that the best funds in the world won't sign it because they don't need to. They are, in every case, oversubscribed. So if they're raising $250 million for their total fund, they may have $300 or $400 million of people at the door to sign up. Those other investors would allow them to sign that side letter because they want the best return period regardless of where it is. But we're not going to invest in them unless we have very good reason to believe that they, in fact, will invest at least as much money as we invest in them in the state. And the hammer we have, independent of the side letter, is if they don't do that when they come back for a second fund a few years later, we look them in the eye and say, you didn't do what you said, and so we won't invest in the second fund. But the challenge we have is while we can get that side letter many times, most of the time, I would say probably 80% of the time at least, we can get that side letter signed. Some of the very best funds on the planet that we want coming to Oregon won't sign it. And so what we're asking for to change in legislation is the word shall to the word may. We may require that as opposed to we shall require that. Now, make no mistake, we know why we're here. You know, we're all Oregonians. We want those funds coming right back here and then some with the leverage of those big funds. But we believe that it is in the interest of the mission of this group to have some flexibility on the board when we need it. And we won't need it that often, but we would like some flexibility to be able to waive that provision from time to time. I'll let John talk about the substantive data behind why we've gotten to that position to ask that of you. But that's where we will come back around.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Finney. I'm the investment consultant to the Oregon Growth Board, and I work for CTC, my CFO. I thought it might be helpful to put together a brief history of how the side letter came into existence, or this specific term within the side letter, just so you have that context and can make your decision based on that. Originally, when the Oregon Growth Account was funded, the initial investments were really skewed toward funds that were domiciled here, making investments in companies that were domiciled here. That was a challenge right out of the gate, being that a lot of institutional capital that could go in and create a very viable operation, a fund to invest here, was finite. There's a lot of interested parties that might be looking at that as an opportunity, but a lot of that would be resident capital, and we are not as robust as other markets, perhaps in California or Seattle, where you have a lot of capital to build out the infrastructure and build a viable firm. So the board recognized that. This is the Legacy Oregon Growth Account Board recognized that and decided that they would expand the scope so that the capital could come in from other locations, not just Oregon-based funds. So that took place post-2002. These funds were often domiciled in adjacent states, Washington, California. To their credit, it did work out. There were a number of funds that came in with very large pools of capital that could be deployed in Oregon-based businesses, which was, I think, the intended result from this. However, one of the challenges that was recognized was there was no obligation attached to the dollars that were being allocated to those funds, and the funds sometimes had other interests that would cause them to invest elsewhere. So in 2008, the Oregon Growth Board began requiring, that's when this term came into the statute, in the side letter, that if a fund were to receive capital from the Oregon Growth Account, it would have to invest at least that amount back into Oregon-based companies. So for instance, if a $5 million commitment were made to a fund, at least $5 million would have to be reinvested back into a company, or companies based here in Oregon. As Chair Langler just mentioned, of the Oregon Growth Board just mentioned, that has worked in many ways. I think a number of these groups take that very seriously. They understand the obligation. It's a legal obligation, and they want to follow through with that. One of the challenges that we've experienced, though, however, is much like Chair Langler just mentioned, a lot of these funds are typically ones that either fall in one of two camps. They are having a challenge fundraising, and they look at this as this is capital that they want because it will help them in their fundraising efforts. There's an institutional name behind them. Or it might be a fund that has somehow strategically determined that Oregon is a place they want to invest. But those are the primary categories that we're looking at. We end up talking with a number of funds since that time. We've ended up talking with a number of funds that have a genuine interest in Oregon, have invested in Oregon, and these are very institutional funds. These are some of the best in the world. And they have reached out to us and said, we would like to work with Oregon Growth Account. And as soon as we bring up the side letter requirement to invest here, it's a showstopper at various stages. It might be right out of the gate, or it might be at the very end of the due diligence of these funds. But nonetheless, that is the end result. In 2014, when the Oregon Growth Board took over, the Oregon Growth Board took over for the Oregon Growth Account, the scope was modified in terms of the the traded sector exposure that this entity would invest in. And there was a lot of introspection about what could be done to make us more effective in generating returns for the Educational Stability Fund. And this became a very pointed topic that I think a number of the board members wanted to address. I was asked to run a quick analysis on how many funds does that equate to. Over the last 3 years, we've had at least 8 instances where very institutional funds across all of the traded sectors have approached us wanting to work with Oregon Growth Account, representing greater than $2 billion in assets that could be coming, that theoretically could be coming here to the state, and all have walked away because of that. And that's a challenge. It's not awful. I think it's, as Chair Langler just mentioned, this is a good thing to hold people accountable and want them to invest here in the state. However, it could also benefit you if you were to think creatively about those groups that have invested here historically, have a vested interest in companies here, and are going to be coming here already, if there might be some flexibility in looking at them perhaps through a different lens. And having that flexibility, I think, would make all the difference. So that's the history, just for your context.
Thank you very much. Ivo, in addition to whatever else you're going to say, I'd love it if you could help us understand the changes around the department and the accounts, the funds being appropriated to the department as opposed to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly what I wanted to talk about.
Yes.
It's a technicality, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ivo Trimmer. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for the Oregon Business Development Department, or Business Oregon for short, here to speak on House Bill 2280. We asked for 3 things in that bill to be considered. One, if you look at page 1, we're hoping the Director of Business Oregon currently is an ex officio member on the Oregon Growth Board. We're hoping that he become a voting member. In the end, the director is required to sign on the dotted line for all investments, transfers, or grants that go out. So we're hoping to make him a voting member so he has a voice in the decision-making process. That does trigger to add another member at large so that there's an even number of board members, yes, I think, for purposes of the vote.
Same thing as an odd number.
Odd number, thank you.
I don't call board members odd.
No, I was just struggling to find the word here. The next is, if you go to Section 2, this refers to the fund. It is a curious technicality. The fund currently is within DAS, so when we sign anything, it's probably one of the few funds in the state where we have to sign, and then another state agency has to sign before the funds can be paid out. So this technicality, because the board is with DAS, if moving it to us will make it easier for us to just pay the bills. That's really what it comes down to. For the fund, Section 3, if you look at that.
Interrupt for just a moment. Excuse me, Representative, was it?
So yes, can we take an FTE from DAS for this?
I'm going to let him off the hook. Let's go on. We'll point that as a rhetorical question.
I'm saving money so we can invest.
I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak for that, but thank you for the question. In Section 3, that has to do with the account. Currently, with the spending limitation, really. Currently, we can't actually expend monies out of the accounts. We have to absorb any expenditures out of our budget, so this will help us actually pay for stuff. So this really, most of this is a technicality. I'll add, maybe for full disclosure, in Ways and Means, we're also asking to add another half FTE to the current half FTE that we got with the Oregon Growth Board. And that really will enable us to bring the function in-house. Currently, the very, very capable Beth Cook helps staff the board, but we want to bring that function in-house so we can have more oversight or more control, and then also pay the bills.
More capacity, I would say. Yes. Very good. Questions? Representative Nierman.
Thanks for your presentation, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having a hard time understanding, why are the investors not wanting to sign the side letter in the first place? Can you help me with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, that's a very good question, right? And so the issue is has a couple different parts to it. If I'm raising a fund and I've got a $250 million fund, and the Oregon Growth Board is offering $5 million, but I've already got way more than $250 in hand. The other investors are going to look at that and say, why are we going to be obligated to invest in any state, not just Oregon, anywhere, as opposed to getting the best return for us, period? And so the general partners, the firms that are making this investment, look at this. I'm not going to risk any of that $245 million commitment to me for the $5 million commitment to me. But that said, so that they sort of don't want to sign it as a legal matter. As a practical matter, they know, and we know that they know, that if they take our money and they don't come back, that they don't get to come back the next time they raise a fund. And so what John Finney was saying was, our approach to this is we are interested in funds that have already shown an interest in investing in Oregon, not just interest, but in fact, many times have already invested in startups here. We know they're coming here. We want them to keep coming here, but they have a problem signing that official legal requirement to do that. Did that answer your question, sir?
Yeah. Can I ask a follow-up?
Please.
Do you expect that that you'll discontinue the letter and just go with the gentleman's agreement of if you don't invest back here, we're not going to do?
No, sir. Chair Reed and Representative Nierman, we expect to continue the side letter most of the time. So the majority of firms will sign it. We want them to sign it. But in the case of those that will not sign it, but we really want to have our investment dollars in so their impact comes back to the state, that will be a gentleman's agreement. It won't be a official document. But again, we're not going to do that in a company that hasn't already demonstrated their behavior operating that way.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
That's a good question.
Other questions? Representative Wizard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two suggestions on the bill. The one at large member, I would really like to see a modifier with that. A successful venture person had a business or something. Just an at large member, that's sort of open ended. I think you want to have. I would just think like to suggest you think about some modifier on that. Experienced venture, someone that started a venture, several successes, and to follow on Representative Nierman's comment, and I spoke to the chair briefly. I'm also in support of this, and I think this is great. I've learned a lot in the last few days. But I think if that side letter some way could, we think about Betsy and how much money we spend in Betsy that never produced any jobs in Oregon or any money returned. If some way that side letter could be stated or modified to say, so a proportion or whatever. The chair mentioned it's regional. A lot of times it's regional investors, so we can't give it all back to Oregon in the way the side letter is now, saying it all has to come back. I agree with that, but I'd really like to see if you could suggest something so the taxpayers that are giving us this money have some assurance it's going to help Oregon.
Thank you for the comments. I would respond to particularly to the first point. Our experience with the growth board so far, and obviously you can read just above the insertion, the other members and the restrictions that are on them, the combination of the experiential requirements and the partisan requirements and the geographic requirements have combined to make it very difficult to get some really talented and experienced people there. So I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate it. We should talk some more about how to do that.
I don't know what the modifier would be.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, sorry for possibly the rookie question, but could you describe what the elements of the side letter are? What are they required, or what are they required just basically to commit to?
Thank you, Representative Hayden. The side letter is actually a very general term. This is a there will always be a side letter with the managers that we work with. This is a very specific term within the side letter that we're looking to relax. The Stephen Marlowe with the Department of Justice would do this more justice. However, the point of it is exactly how it's described. If there is an investment in a fund, if there is a promise to commit capital or to provide capital to a fund that you are investing in, that capital that goes into that fund, an equal or greater amount has to be invested back into companies eventually over the life of that fund. So the expectation is if you had a $250 million fund, $5 million went into that, they would find either a company or multiple companies where they would invest perhaps right out of the gate or over the entire life of the fund, that $5 million in those companies. That's a very simplified version of it, but that's the general understanding.
Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. As I said before, this is just a public hearing for today, but we'll be back to it, I suspect, quite soon. That will close the public hearing on House Bill 2280. Unless there's anyone else who wants to testify, I didn't see anyone. Please come forward. Ah, Mr. Parker, I'm sorry. Okay. I had you on for the next bill, and I didn't make the transition to 2280. We're glad you're
no
here.
No problem
happy
at all.
To hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Nat Parker. I'm the founder and the CEO of Globe Sherpa. We're a technology company based in Portland that's best known for developing the mobile payments app for TriMet that lets you buy your bus ticket directly from your smartphone. We're a direct beneficiary of the activities of the Oregon Growth Board. We've taken money from OAF, Oregon Angel Fund, Portland Seed Fund as well. So while we don't run into the same issues, I think from a regional perspective, these are companies or organizations that invest directly in Oregon and Portland startups. I'm just here to voice my support for the activities of the board. This is something that has allowed my company to grow phenomenally. We're 25 people today. We have tripled revenue year over year, and we continue to grow. So I just wanted to voice my support and say this is a tangible, absolute material impact on people in the state. And there are ancillary benefits to the activities of the fund and the board itself. Even if you don't return a huge year-over-year investment from the companies in which you invest, you're building a talent pool. And what we're seeing is that people, software engineers, other professionals in companies like mine are jumping from company to company. So there are peripheral benefits, I think, to the investment activities of the board, and there are direct benefits by way of the money we generate and the jobs we create. And these are good jobs. These are high-paying, very quality jobs. We pay 100% of the health care for all of our employees. We give them ownership stakes in the company itself. And so I think we're creating an ethos and an investment approach that's uniquely Oregon. So this is something where I wanted to voice my support, let you know that we are very fortunate and very lucky for your support of this this program. And we're here to help in any way that we can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Parker? Okay, with that, I think we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2280, and we'll move to a second bill related to the Growth Board, House Bill 2276. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2276 appropriates monies to the Oregon Growth Board for purposes of performing the duties, functions, and powers of the board, declares an emergency as effective July 1, 2015, and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
A little bit of background. The question here is whether the legislature will send some money to the Growth Board to continue doing the work that it's been doing. We have two people who have signed up to testify here, Terry Brandt and Sheila Holden. If you'd like to come forward, we'd appreciate it.
Chairman, can I provide a little bit of background?
Sure. Beth, please come forward as well.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I just want to give a really brief background. You've just heard a lot about the activities regarding
identifiers.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Beth Cook. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Growth Board. I am here today just to give a little bit of background. This particular bill relates to the Oregon Growth Fund. So you've heard a lot about the umbrella of the Oregon Growth Board over the last week. And I believe on Monday that Chair Langer covered a little bit about the nuances between the Oregon Growth Account, which is that's where you have the side letter requirements and those types of nuances you were just discussing under House Bill 2280. So under the Oregon Growth Fund, this is the fund in particular. It's currently at $1.9 million. And this first biennium, this is the first biennium that we've had the fund. This is a fund that actually focuses on early stage women, minority, and rural entrepreneurs. to developing opportunities within those sectors. And so Mr. Grant is here today to discuss one of the projects that the board has invested in over the last year, and take from there.
Thank you for the background. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Please.
Chair Reed, representatives of the committee, my name is Terry Brandt. I'm with Albina Opportunities Corporation. I'm here to also offer some information, hopefully some bright news, economic news about what's going on with Albina Opportunities and helping small businesses in Oregon. To my right are a few pictures that I brought along. Sometimes one picture is worth a thousand words. They are representative of borrowers that we have that are part of our community that we've established with Albina Opportunities Corporation. We were formed about 6 years ago. I'm the founding executive director of the of AOC. It was founded by a group of successful business people, including Duncan Campbell, John Emmerich, Jim Meyer, Robert Stoll, and a few others, along with some investment by the Meyer Memorial Trust and Oregon Community Foundation. We are a nonprofit, a non-bank lender to businesses in Portland's underserved communities to expand their businesses and hire more employees, but of which who cannot obtain funds from traditional banking resources. It has been, we have been economically creating opportunity and hundreds of jobs in Portland's community to these underserved folks. And there was a need that was seen, especially during the economic crisis that occurred in 2008. That suggested, and as we could reflect on that, we all went through a period where traditional banks were not there loaning money to small businesses to help them stay in business. It was a unique time for us. We stepped into the breach and started providing what I'd call microloans on steroids. It's really a microlending program that we have, but our average loan size is about $80,000. Compared to what many of you may reflect on as a microlending platform, which is in the $5,000 to $10,000 range. Over the last 6 years, we've made dozens of loans to many small businesses to expand, and they've created over 500 new jobs. We don't provide handouts. We provide funds and business advisory service support to have these small businesses help themselves. We've, in fact, require that you have not been able to qualify for loan funds from a traditional bank, and as a result, all of our loans, interestingly enough, have all been repaid without any loan losses. We supply this money in the range of $50,000 to $200,000. We call this group the missing middle. The reason why we refer to it as the missing middle is that large banks have difficulty cost-effectively underwriting loans that are less than $300,000 to $350,000. So unless you qualify to walk in and get a home equity line of credit with a home that had been underwater, now their home equity values are coming back. But unless it's an easy underwritten loan, it's not cost-effective for them to get involved. On the flip side of that, below the $300,000 to $350,000 level are the microlenders that are serving a niche in this marketplace as well. But the max that they loan is $50,000. So you have what we call this missing middle, this gap. In fact, in Portland right now, we are the only lender that are providing lines of credit to small businesses that don't qualify for any other resources, with the exception of companies that are factoring companies or hard money lenders. This, as of the sixth year of our operations, We've had, or we're going on our fourth audited year of financial reports. We've been issued a clean opinion on all of the 3 years. We expect that to continue with our fourth year. We are have just been recertified as a CDFI. That is a designation referred to as Community Development Financial Institution, for those of you who are not familiar with that. It's issued by the Department of the Treasury. We've continued to receive funds from Myra Memorial Trust, Collins Foundation, Oregon Growth Fund provided us with funding this last fall. We're very appreciative of that. And in fact, that money, as soon as we got it, we put it into new loans. The Bank of California has also recently provided us with a loan that is a loan based on what we'd like to refer to as a ratio of $4 of debt for every $1 of equity. So that is to say, when we get grant funds, every dollar we get in a grant, we're able to match that up with some bank money. The banks are interested in funding us because we provide investments in what are called Community Reinvestment Act CRA credits. They are required to invest in by the U.S. government. To date, we've had, as I mentioned, no loan losses. We have predominantly focused our loans on not only distressed communities within our Portland area, but also women and minorities. Well, nearly 70% of our loans have been to women, and nearly 50% of our loans have been to minorities. This group in and of itself has been underserved and underbanked for way too long. So I'm here to thank Oregon Growth Board for supporting us. We'd like to think that we could qualify for additional funding in the future. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Any questions? Mr. Brandt. Representative Reardon.
Thank you for coming in. It's good to see you. Just wondering about the distribution of loans. Have they been predominantly in the metro area or across the state? Or
Representative Reardon, that's a great question. It's been primarily in our four-county area, which actually includes Clark County across the river. I think we've done one loan only in Clark County. But we have focused most of our loans in Multnomah County, and we are now starting to get out into Clackamas County and Washington County. So there are a great number of minorities that are wanting access to this capital. We've had this problem in the past of not having enough money to actively market our fund. We have now over $1 million of requests that are qualified requests that we've just recently been able to get sufficient funds to fund. So I was just out in Gresham not too long ago with Metro, with a new contract we have with Metro to help them administer their storefront improvement program. So there's a unique opportunity for organizations like ours to leverage public money like Metro's that are trying to help small businesses complete their storefront improvements. But a lot of the businesses, because it's a matching fund that Metro requires, don't have the funds to match. They can't go down the street to the local bank and borrow the money to match those funds because of some restrictions. We, on the other hand, and it's the reason why we were chosen to work with Metro, can offer those small businesses access to capital to then again leverage those small amounts of public money. And in addition to that, we take a look at inside the business and help them with some interior improvements in addition to the storefront dollars.
I can speak to that as well, Chair Reed, Representative Reed. Albion Opportunities Corporation is an example of one of the partners that the Growth Board has been working with over this year, and we've also partnered already with Craft 3. So I started my position in April, and so a lot of that has been examining the ecosystem to see what the best possible opportunities for the Growth Fund will be. We have a fund, excuse me, a microagriculture fund that will be being considered in at the March meeting that is based in the Willamette Valley that is going to be focused on rural entrepreneurs throughout Oregon. As you heard from Craft 3 here on Monday, they have already, they've been focusing initially, you know, they were granted a small loan amount, it was $225,000 loan, to focus on the North Coast area in particular. We're already in conversations with them about other regions that they might be able to serve, because again, it's about providing that leverage. And as Mr. Brandt mentioned, that when you provide $1, you might be able to make that go $4 or $5, you know, you might be able to expand upon that. And that's really what the Growth Board has been focusing on, is how can we leverage the $1.9 million that was allocated this biennium so that it has a much broader impact throughout the state than just that $1.9 million would normally cover.
Thanks for that context. That's helpful. Thank you both. Once again, just a public hearing today, but we'll return to this issue as well. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2276, unless there's anyone else who'd like to testify on it. And open public hearing on House Bill 2434. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2434 directs the Oregon Business Development Department to establish and administer the Natural Resource Transformative Technology Grant Program for purpose of providing grants to assist Oregon's businesses and research institutions to invest in and commercialize transformative natural resource technologies in this state. Establishes Natural Resource Transformative Technology Grant Program Fund and appropriates monies in fund to the department, declares an emergency, is effective on passage, and has multiple referrals to rural communities, land use, and water, then to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. We're glad that the number of people who are interested in this have been patient, and we're here now at the show you've all been waiting for. Director Robbins will start us off, been supported from the governor's office, and former Senator Vicki Walker, now at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We're glad you're here, too. Mr. Robbins.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sean Robbins, the director of the Oregon Business Development Department, Business Oregon. Here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2434, the tongue twister, the Transformative Technology Grant Program for Natural Resources. The impetus for this proposal actually came from constituents as we conducted our state tour this past summer in partnership with the Regional Solution Centers and the Oregon Business Plan, reaching out to the 11 regions of the state, both metro and non-metro alike, to determine two basic things. One, which is what are the unique opportunities and challenges in these communities from an economic development perspective? And two, what is the Oregon Business Development Department's unique responsibility to try and address those opportunities and challenges? As the new director of, as of June 1st of this past year of the agency, this was the best way for me to get a sense of where we were being effective and where we could be more effective than perhaps we've been in the past, especially as it relates to the rural economies, which is an area where I think additional lift from an economic development perspective has been needed, and a place where I'm working to take our agency to be more of an influence. One of the things that we learned along the way was that rural economic development actually means natural resource economic development in many rural communities, food, wood products being the two most obvious. That's no epiphany to many of the folks in those areas. But from an economic development perspective, we thought it was important to begin to distinguish what we mean by rural from the economy perspective. And really, when you think about the natural resource economies, there's the historic legacy way of looking at this from the sort of bushels and board feet perspective, which is harvest levels from these two industries. But there's also an additional way that we're proposing to begin to look and talk about these industries, and that's from the innovation perspective and the future perspective, which is how do we build on the legacy strengths of our ability to grow and produce some of the most sustainable natural resources and harvest those resources in the world, but also how do we become innovation players within that space as the world's population grows, so on and so forth. So really, this is an attempt to begin to bring the same level of attention for innovation, commercialization, technology within natural resource as has been in the past with the Oregon Innovation Council Signature Research Centers through nanotechnology, building systems, life sciences. In many ways, as you can see in the legislation, the vision for this is to create, if you will, an Oregon Inc.-like process that sits side by side, but specifically for natural resources, a competitive process in which industry experts are assembled to determine eligibility, application, to determine where the best investment should be made to catalyze those technologies, both in industry, also potentially in higher education, but industry is just as much of an equal footing, in large part because most of the basic research and development that gets commercialized, while we talk about it at the university side, is often from private industry first. So we want to be able to address those two opportunities, and we also want to be able to implement clear performance guidelines for those investments. It's a small, modest investment of $5 million going forward, but we believe it's important to give the same real estate, if you will, to natural resource innovation as has been given to some of the more innovation, traditional innovation-based industries like life science, nanotechnology has been in the past. There's plenty of examples of where these industry investments could be made. We have folks here smarter and better and more equipped to talk about those than me. But I'll leave it at that, and just to say that this is the first attempt for our agency to begin to be useful in that space based on the constituents that we heard on the ground about, if you will, making many of these industries sunrise industries of the future.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gallegos, members of the committee. My name is Vince Porter. I'm the governor's policy advisor on jobs and the economy. I just want to build on Sean's comments about we toured with Sean around the state and learned quite a bit ourselves when we were out. And in the governor's budget there, we specifically called out over $200 million of investment, of new investment, that we felt was needed to address some immediate and long-term opportunities in rural Oregon. This is one of the, this is five of that $200 million. And the reason why we felt this was important is that there are, you can see the trends moving, and there are opportunities that we see right in front of us today that in the next 10 to 15 years, Oregon can play a significant leadership role in new technologies and new ways of using our natural resources and adding value so that our logs are not leaving our docks without adding value to them, and our crops are not leaving our state without having the opportunity to add value. So we felt it was very important, but the one thing I do want to just add to it is what we did not intend to put into this. You know, there's a lot of discussion about wood first or carbon first initiatives. We don't really see this as a bill that is to address that issue. We see this as an opportunity to look at innovation and look at places that all over the world are taking a leadership role, when in our own backyard we're the ones well positioned to be the actual leaders. And so while there are many materials and many opportunities in front of us, we should look at what is available and how Oregon can take a leadership role and ultimately enhance our rural economies. So thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gallegos and members of the committee. Some of you I know and some of you I don't, so it's a pleasure to meet you. I'm former Senator Vicky Walker, and one thing that hasn't changed in this hearing room is it's still hot. So I'm here today representing the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development. I am the state director for that agency within the department. There are 17 agencies within the department, and we're just one of them. But we have a huge contribution in Oregon, as you can see. I provided you with a document that shows you some of the investments we've made, as well as a copy of my testimony, so I'll hit the highlights of those. We have three agencies within my agency, the Rural Housing Service, the Rural Utilities Service, and the Rural Business and Cooperative Service. And in these three agencies, we have improved the quality of life and the economy in rural Oregon. By and large, we operate only in rural Oregon. There are some exceptions where we'll touch an urban area that has an impact in a rural community. Since President Obama took office in 2009, I just want to highlight for you that we have invested $3.5 billion in the state of Oregon. That's a B, billion dollars. That's a whole lot of dough, to put it in the vernacular. And it was really a pleasure for me to tag along with Business Oregon this past year as they went out and scoped what Oregonians were really thinking about their own economy, because we're a strong believer that rural Oregon knows what they need. But sometimes they just need some help in accessing those things, and they need some help in leveraging funding. And we're all about leveraging, and we work very hard with the state of Oregon to leverage some funds. So let me give you some examples and why I think House Bill 2434 is really a great way to achieve some of these concepts. In 2009, when I first took office, Sustainable Northwest was given a $500,000 cooperative agreement with our agency, and this is like within the first week of me being on the job, and I'm like, wow, that's a lot of money. Is it always going to be like that? Well, it's not. But the cooperative agreement acted like a grant, and it asked Sustainable Northwest to develop economic development solutions across the dry forest zone. So they went out and did great things with that money. They partnered up to support forest-based small business development and emerging collaborative groups at multiple scales. And these collaboratives then created other partnerships and what you now know as the Western Juniper Alliance. It got its start with our cooperative agreement. And as you know, juniper has a real problem. It causes a real problem on the landscape all over eastern Oregon, certainly with invasive weeds, increased wildfire. It also sucks up the water out of the ground, poor livestock grazing, and it certainly impacts sage-grouse habitat. So we wanted to find something to do with juniper. Well, we aren't the only ones who put money in this deal, and this is where you all need to feel really proud. And as a former member, these are the kinds of things I like to hear. So you all put up money. The Oregon State Legislature put money in. Oregon Solutions, Business Oregon, Oregon Community Foundation, and USDA Rural Development. Now, in addition to the $500,000 we put in initially, we brought $65,000 to the table last year, and that partnered up with funds from Oregon Department of Transportation and Business Oregon so that Oregon State University could test juniper so that it could get certified and we can use juniper in highway projects, bridges, and buildings, because until it met the certification, it couldn't technically be used in those projects. So you see how it just has a snowball effect. And this bill is all about innovation and what we can do to increase the economy. We've also seen innovation in our food systems. USDA Rural Development put in about $275,000 into Food Hub, which is at EcoTrust in Portland. And there's an example of how we can play in an urban community, because its impact on the rural community was huge. And not only it now there's over 5,700 registered users in Food Hub where they buy and sell their goods. School districts use it. The Oregon Farm to School program, which we created when I was here, they use Food Hub. And in addition, Clackamas County, former Senator Martha Schrader, now back back on the commission wanted to create a food hub in Clackamas County. So we participated in their one-stop program. That was an Oregon Solution project. So again, here we are working with the state. That network building has included Northwest Food Buyers Alliance and Oregon Harvest for Schools. So we became the platform for that foundation. And that's what this bill is all about, creating that platform where you can go and do great things. We also, and I know Representative McEwen knows about this, we put money into $250,000 into the Port of Bandon Economic Development Fund, and they in turn lent that money to Face Rock Creamery to create a place where cheese is once again in Bandon. And so the cows are milked in Coquille. The milk is shipped down within a couple of hours to Bandon, and they start making cheese. And I think it's become one of the biggest sellers of Umpqua ice cream in the state because the lines are long every time you go down there. Again, we were involved with Business Oregon in that project. And I always remind Sean when he puts out his little press releases, if he forgets to mention us, I send him a pinging email and say, wait a minute, we had money in that project too. So I just want you to know that all of this collective ability to support sustainable rural economies is really dependent upon collaborative cooperation. And the federal government can't write the big check. You can't write the big check, and the foundations cannot do it, and the nonprofits. But when we work together, we can achieve great things. And I am so proud of the work that my agency has done since I have been at the helm. And they did good work before, but you know, I'm going to put a star on my good deeds, and I think we've really gone beyond what we've ever done before in working with rural Oregon. So that would be my testimony today, and I know some other great things have come along that we'll be testifying on later this session, but members, this is really good stuff.
Thank you very much. My apologies for the departure. Representative Williamson, Representative Wisnett, and I are also on Ways and Means, which is, as you're all familiar with, kind of in a holding pattern. We may have to escape again in a couple of minutes. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Hayden, then Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question on the – you mentioned that this bill is not about carbon. And my question on that are natural resources and coming from a very rural community – the carbon sink or the removal or scrubbing of carbon from our environment is best done through some of our natural resources and sequestering that carbon in timber, turning that timber into some product and letting the timber grow back up, not a discussion of old growth or not, but just proper timber management. So why would this not include that as part of the benefits or the discussion towards our environment if we do have proper timber management reducing carbon levels below what they may be if we don't have proper timber management? Could you address that?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, I made the comments to make sure that that doesn't cloud the issue that there are innovation opportunities. I do believe that you know, we're looking at the science, and I think it's also important to note that the science needs to be out there to further that argument, and which is something we very much support. But I just wanted to make sure we went on the record to say that this is not intended to be something where we are tilting one versus the other, but that innovation in this fund should be the focus, and innovation in our natural resources that, you know, if they ultimately bring a carbon sequestration or an environmental benefit, whether it's forest health or others, that's fantastic and great. But I would hate to have that issue cloud what the opportunity is in economic development.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Reardon?
Oh, just a comment. I wanted to testify that this is actually, it is working.
You got to testify, you got to go around.
Well, no, I will comment, this is actually working. I have evidence here. So I want you to know that I have written a big check. It was big to me. Bought juniper. We have 6 garden boxes just installed in our yard this week made from juniper from Sustainable Northwest, which I purchased in the Portland area. So the program's working, and I'm doing my part to help rural Oregon. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rudin, I'm glad to hear that, and I want you to know that I have a growler box made of juniper, and it's a dual growler box. And when I go to fill my growler at the local pub, everyone says, wow, where did you get that? Because it's a work of art. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful, and it just makes me feel proud to take it in and buy Oregon beer in my Oregon juniper growler box.
Perhaps there's a little bit of one-upsmanship here. We can keep this going. Who has more juniper products? This bodes well. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Without spending a lot of time, I just want to thank all three of you for the hard work. Being on the road as long as you were last summer was onerous. You did a wonderful job of, I think, getting a real great sense of what's happening in our rural communities across the state. And this innovation issue is a remarkable thing for those of us who live in rural communities. The cross-laminated timber initiative is just really remarkable. We have an opportunity to transform architectural practices, and I'm just very excited about that. We have other food processing issues that are innovative and new, where things are happening in a different way. There are great opportunities out there. Face Rock, I probably have a few extra pounds. You can't go through Bandon without stopping and having an ice cream cone and picking up some cheese.
Right.
Exactly. And I go to Agnes often, so it's good, but there's a downside. But we're really excited about the work that you're doing and the fact that there is an eye towards these things, I think, in this session. So the work that you thank you. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Very good. Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really support the concept, but I do think we need to recall or remember that we do have some programs in place that are doing some really good work in rural Oregon. I just want to refer to the OSU Extension offices and so forth. And as we talk about creating new programs that are going to require revenue, and there's always a competition for those dollars and stuff, I want to make sure that we don't do that at the expense of some really good work that's going on across the state of Oregon now. But one of the other issues that pops up for me as I read the bill, and I think this will perhaps be an ongoing concern for hopefully for all of us, but you know, the bill calls for consulting with the governor's office and so forth about establishing criteria and setting up the program, and you know, it's really hard to know who that will be, what those values will be, who will be providing that kind of leadership. And when we have an emergency clause on a bill like this, for me, I think it might be better received if there was some sort of a point in the future when this would take effect and we would actually have a chance to look at and evaluate what this program looks like when it's fully put together. So, but again, this is, we're in uncertain waters here. I think we all understand that. But I think we need to proceed prudently and with our eyes wide open.
So, Representative Johnson, thank you for the comment, both about the reminder of the other things that are operating in the general sphere, and you actually picked up on version of my concern. And I was going to ask questions and a couple of questions and say, you may well have covered this while I was out of the room, in which case perhaps I can follow up with you afterwards, but perhaps a little more about what those criteria look like, how big awards might be, how ROI might be measured, and that sort of stuff. And feel free to just say, we covered that while you were gone, and we can follow up later if that's true. But I think that's kind of along the lines of what you're talking about as well.
Chair Reed, thank you. And those are all very good questions. Sean covered a little bit in terms of really looking at Oregon Inc. as a successful model to structure something like this and run in tandem with how Oregon Inc. operates in regards to the size of grants and the process. I think part of that has to do with probably what the size of the number is. I would not think we would want to do a peanut butter approach to this effort and spread it out too thin. So a lot of that ought to depend on what the size of the fund is, as far as how many grants and what the size. Because I think to do something significant, we would need a sizable amount of money in certain initiatives to allow that. And to the extent we could have that flexibility within the framework of a appropriate committee to make those decisions is something we'd be very much in support of.
Chair Reed, in addition to Vince's answer, one of the things I mentioned, and when it relates to the in tandem or in parallel to the Oregon Inc. model. And I think to Representative Johnson's question as well is some very clear parameters around the working group of experts, industry experts, that are really in charge of a competitive application process for these grants or whatever financial product is ultimately developed in to invest in these. So it's a process, a very competitive process. It's got industry experts driving the decisions as much as anyone else. And that there are clear performance guidelines put in place anytime a financial investment is made, regardless of the institution which would receive that of any size, so that the taxpayers and the department and the rest of us have a very clear expectation of what it is intended to produce and what the quantitative output is of that investment.
Thanks. Thanks for the answer. I have to compliment you, too. While you were answering that in a very substantive way, I got an email from you, so I don't know how you're doing those simultaneously. It's very impressive. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, I just... Innovation.
Yeah,
impressive. Innovation.
Yes. There you go.
I'm very supportive, and thank you for putting rural Oregon on the screen. And that's... Part of my question is there some sort of, in your tour of the state, is there a way that you're thinking about prioritizing communities or, you know, our efforts in particular areas?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Gallegos, I will tell you that Oregon, as a result of the listening sessions and as a result of a request by our secretary, Tom Vilsack, we have targeted four areas of the state that are high in poverty. These areas are over 20% poverty, and we're starting in Josephine County in the Cave Junction area. We're headed out this week to Malheur County. We're working in the Warm Springs area, where we've done significant work, and also along the Mid-Columbia area. And I would let Representative Johnson know that Freem Brewery got its start with funding from USDA Rural Development, and through innovation, they're expanding and coming back for more. So we don't give those grants and loans out lightly. We require a showing that they've done successful things. So in terms of our involvement, we're really focused on the high poverty areas, and in conjunction with what Business Oregon is doing, we like to piggyback on those things, and with Oregon Solutions, and I'll let Sean respond to that further.
Thank you, Chair Reed, Representative Gallegos. Two points to that question. One is, and I think this is an opportunity to develop the program together and in partnership with this committee. I would offer that we're really following the opportunities, not necessarily one particular county over another, by the various circumstances, industry-driven, it's industry-focused, natural resources, wood, and food, essentially, systems. We'll follow those opportunities wherever those might be first. Second, and as a follow-on perhaps to my first question, which might drive a little additional thought to your question on geography, is an additional criteria I think is important to consider is the match component to an investment. We don't want to be, as we haven't been, but in the future with USDA, federal government partners, foundation, community, other state agencies, local, private funds. We want to be part of those investments so that everyone has some skin in the game. And I think that's a great way to provide some market mechanism feedback to us to determine the fact that other partners feel that this is a worthwhile investment as well. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you for the introduction and for your patience and we're going to move back and forth between folks who are on our list. So I'd like to call up Jody Weiser, Rich Angstrom, and Ryan Tribbett next, please.
We're done yet.
Jody, do you want to get us started? We can hear from the other gentleman.
Good morning, members of this committee. My name's Rich Angstrom, and I am the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I also represent many of the other mining mineral interests now in the state, have expanded our membership from just the construction materials folks. I want to start out the discussion on this bill as what's interesting about sometimes you think a bill is headed in one direction, and then you get to sit and listen to testimony, and you think you realize that the framers are coming from a different perspective, and that there might be some convergence of activities within the state that folks may not all be aware of. And to bring that all to that meaning to fruition here for you folks is, there's a couple of things that our industry, the concrete industry and the minerals industries, have been doing to advance the economies also throughout Oregon during the interim. In fact, during legislative days in the House Ag, as Representative Reardon knows, we had a whole half an hour, 45 minutes, I think, of talking about the innovations within our industry and brought in examples for the various legislators to hold on to and look at as our industry advances in the free market arena. The other thing that's of interest is Dave Honeycutt and I just came back from Eastern Oregon working with Greg Smith and Cliff Bentz on mining symposium and looking at what the issues are going on over on the east side and what the economic opportunities are over in Eastern Oregon from the mining perspective. And just as a side, because I got a captive audience and it's all on point here, is we compared Oregon's economy with Humboldt County, Nevada, which is hopping. Its employment base is just incredible, with Malheur and Harney and Baker and all of those counties. And where we saw forestry and ranching being components of each one, the difference was of what Humboldt was doing versus our Eastern Oregon counties has had an active mining program going on and had a burgeoning of opportunity, economic opportunity for those counties. The big thing is if you looked at the economic prosperity of those Eastern Oregon counties, it's some of the worst in the country, where Humboldt was one of the best in the country. And we identify that as the interest. The other thing is, which really struck me, because I just came off the Steens Mountain Advisory Committee, a federal advisory committee, as we spent an inordinate amount of time working on how to deal with juniper, which is, folks really don't know, is devastating to the east side. It's hard to burn. It's hard to burn up during forest fires. It's a unique plant that not only sends down a deep tap root, but a horizontal root system that's very extensive, and it literally sucks all the water out of the system to where I've on these tours that I've been on for the federal government, is even grass doesn't grow. It goes that far. So when I look at this bill, and I think it's about natural resources, I realize that it's kind of product specific, and it doesn't really talk about all of Oregon's natural resources and the opportunity for all the natural resources, including the mining and the construction materials aspects of the industry. And the other side of it is it does then touch, because the way it's focused and how we compete, it has some elements of some issues I might have over how free markets might work as we all compete with one another. So with that kind of background said, we think that this bill should be modified a little bit. It should include all natural resources. It should have some statement in there about the importance of mining and mineral and the opportunity that can be explored there. It should look at a little more closely how all of us that compete more on the construction material side are competing with one another to make sure free markets are preserved. But this is a huge opportunity for the state. And for all of us natural resources to be able to, get some of our innovations out there, like what we showed the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. And our folks would take advantage of this, too. And this bill could be done in a manner that would be good for all. And I like that. I checked off neutral because of that, even though I have some specific language issues. But the opportunity's there, and I really appreciate the efforts of the governor's office on going out and trying to create opportunities for all the natural resource community. So with that, Jareed, thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, Ryan Tribbett, PacWest, here today on behalf of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, the Ironworkers Local 29, and the Bricklayers Local 1. We also have some of the same concerns that Mr. Angstrom described about product biases. We represent 25,000 workers that also build competing wall systems and things. I'm thinking specifically, if I was to point out a specific line or two in the bill that I find problematic, would be page 2, line 21 and 22. Speaking to pilot projects for tall wood buildings, a review of the building code, I think, to allow for larger wood structures to be built and things. I fully support all of the things that people testifying before me have said about helping the rural economy develop and whatnot, and certainly the building trades and our members statewide would love to see that. It would benefit them. I just haven't heard anyone articulate how changing the building code to allow for specifically taller wood structures helps meet that end. It seems like it's embedding a sort of product bias towards and picking winners and losers and things. And I would like, Mr. Engstrom said, like to see this benefit everyone collectively. Promoting Oregon innovation is something we can all celebrate. I just think the particular bias in here is inappropriate. So I also was looking at this without, and I appreciate the question that Ms. Reed had asked about the size of the grants going out. Typically in state policy, when more than $750,000 of public money goes to a private developer, which has potential to go to in this, for purposes of construction project, prevailing wage is a standard. And I can't tell in here in this language if prevailing wage is an expectation, if it gets to a certain threshold or not. But I would hope that there would be some clarification on that at some point before you pass it.
Thank you. Ms. Weiser.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I come before you today because while the innovative ideas that we heard at the hearings earlier this year were really exciting, I looked at the fact that it's a grant program in an area where we already have layers of subsidy for natural resources in the state. We have a university system, we have a tax code, we have extension services, we have, you know, lots of different places where it seems like this work would already have a natural home rather than a new grant program. And we're also concerned that when we do grant programs, we don't get an equity investment out of it. If we're giving money to a private business, we should be getting some ownership interest, or it should be a loan. No other investors just give money. So why would the state do that? And the bill allows this money to go to universities, but also to private businesses, and so that would be a concern. Our tax code supports research and development in a couple of different ways. If a business wanted to take on doing the research that the bill calls for, they would be able to deduct all their expenses for that business, and they would be able to get a research and development tax credit up to $1 million. And for the most part, these businesses are not poor businesses. They're large businesses with quite a bit of capacity. And so I wonder about starting another new program when Regional Solutions might be able to deal with it, the Extension Service might be able to do this, the university system might be able to do this, and the tax system would support doing it. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Don't see any? Thank you very much. The last panel on House Bill 2434 is Jeremy Rogers, Joel Fisher, and Heather Stafford, please. Once again, as you're getting settled, it may be that I have to rush out of here to Ways and Means, so don't think it's anything you said. Please.
All right. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher. For the record, I'm with the Oregon Business Association. I made it through fifth grade without having any rules. We had an incredible teacher who didn't actually set any rules for us until near the end of the school year. We got out of hand one day, and he said, all right, there's one rule, and that's don't tell me something that I already know. And it's a sad fact of life as a legislator that inevitably some of the people sitting up here are going to tell you things that you already know. But if you can go back with me about a year and a half to the economic forecast that we all saw, and that Oregon is coming out of the recession, we're coming out, you know, relatively strong and doing pretty good. But then you separate out Portland, and we're coming out even stronger. And then you look at rural Oregon, and we're just holding steady or still in economic decline. And I like to think it was my idea, but actually a lot of people had the idea that we need to do something to focus on rural Oregon. And so Oregon Business Association called up Jeremy over at the Oregon Business Council and Sean Robbins at Business Oregon, and we said, you know, we've got to go out there and talk to people in rural Oregon and find out what it is that we can do to really move the needle in rural Oregon. So we plan this 2-month-long tour that I think you've already heard a little bit about, you will continue to hear a lot about, and we're going to keep beating the drumbeat on that message all session long, because we spent 2 months doing a whole lot of really important work. We spent, you know, every morning touring local businesses and talking with local business leaders, and in the afternoons holding economic development forums, again, meeting with more local business owners, university and college people, education leaders, economic development people, local leaders, and asking them, you know, across a variety of subjects, what is it that that the state can do to partner with you to help the economy in rural Oregon. So we covered things from, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship to business development to natural resources. And this bill before you, House Bill 2434, is a direct result of the hard work that we did this summer. So, you know, as people have pointed out, there are some layers of things that are really helpful. The extension, you know, and we would love to sing the praises of the extension services and experiment stations, but the economic data shows that there's still more that we can be doing. And so with that, we urge your support of House Bill 2434.
Thank you, sir. Who's next?
Chair Reed, for the record, Jeremy Rogers with the Oregon Business Council. And I staff the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort among many business organizations and partnership with the public sector as well. You've heard about the tour, so I won't talk about that other than I facilitated in those sessions most of the natural resource industry conversations, and there is a remarkable set of opportunities that exist across the state. As Director Robbins said, natural resources is a sunrise industry, not a sunset industry, and the opportunities are growing, but we have to take advantage of them. And you've heard about some of those today, but within our forest products industry, you know, the innovative and collaborative ways that we're going about forest management, the new products that we can develop, including cross-laminated timber and tall wood buildings, but a lot of other things as well. These are real opportunities. These were the things that people are talking about on the ground in food. Every community sees opportunities to add more value to their food products and to increase exports in their food products and to grow their food processing capacity. These are poor communities. You know, we know that. The resources that exist there are not significant to make those kinds of investments. And this is part of a package of a lot of other things, and I really appreciate Representative Johnson's comment. You know, the OSU statewide's a huge part of that and a huge priority, and ultimately decisions are going to have to be made about where resources go. But we all have to put on a full front in terms of investing in rural Oregon, because it's going to take a lot of things together. There's no one silver bullet. And another thing I'll throw out there, you know, every community that we met with, the opportunity presented by unmanned aerial vehicles to help our natural resource industries. These are huge opportunities, and ones that Oregon has a unique advantage in. Economies are place-based, and we're entering a period of time where people want to reconnect with natural materials. They want to reconnect with their food. They want to reconnect with their buildings. And we are, you know, it's for the last 30 years, it's been a story of decline. And now there's a period of time where we could be at the forefront of an economic reinvention, but only if we make investments, and other places are beating us. In Europe, there's countries in Europe that get, you know, a significant portion, I think some even majority of their energy from biomass. There are 20 and 25 story wood buildings going up in places around the world, not here and not with Oregon wood and not with Oregon architects. And I mentioned it's kind of a package of things. I agree that this should be resource neutral. It's about natural resources, and so we should make sure that mining and other things are included in that. And I want to mention another bill. I don't think it's before this committee, but was also a companion bill to this that came out of these forums, is an infrastructure, rural infrastructure fund, and that'll be heard next week, I think, in a different committee. And that bill was designed specifically, actually, to address a concern that was raised related to mining. And if you came to the Oregon Business Summit, you heard Representative Vance speak about Gentura Cutoff Road, an infrastructure project where there's 90 jobs on the line based on one road that needs to be replaced. And you have a company that put some funds into that, but there isn't enough of a match to get the job done. And that rural infrastructure fund was designed because of that story. So this is a whole package of things to help all of our rural industries. And I really hope that we don't neglect to make these investments we all know are important because of, you know, any petty reasons. There are all sorts of opportunities across all of our natural resource industries, and we should take advantage of all of them. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Ms. Stafford.
Before we go to Mrs. Stafford, Mr. Chair, thank you. Would both of your organizations support amending the bill as it is to include the testimony that we heard before and that you've endorsed so strongly?
I probably would need to check with people, but my initial blush would be I would support that.
I was planning on waiting to until we concluded the testimony, but it's certainly my intention to see what possibilities exist around that.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Stafford, do you need to ask a question now? Should we hear from Ms. Stafford first?
I'd like to hear their response.
Okay, sure.
Could you, either of you, not quite interchangeable, but I talk to you both all the time, so could you comment on the grant versus loan concept that was discussed earlier? How would there be a detriment to the program if it was a loan program versus a grant?
Representative Reardon, Chair Reed, you know, grant programs are more effective in terms of, particularly you're talking about, I mentioned rural communities and rural companies that are not big companies. I mean, what we're talking about here is not likely to go to really, really large companies, as you heard before. These are new technologies, and they're small companies. And so a grant program is going to be a more efficient way to get the result you're looking for. I'm not a finance expert, Business Oregon would probably have more data and experience to tell you how their grant programs versus their loan programs have performed and what's happened. But my general sense is if you're dealing with new enterprises and new technologies, that you're going to be much better off with a grant program. And I know that there's concern, but if you look around the U.S. and around the world in terms of investments in new technologies, we are very shy here, very shy. And if we don't step it up, we're going to lose these opportunities.
Thank you. Ms. Stafford, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Reed and Council. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you again. I want to bring this sort of back to the ground. Oh, Heather Stafford, Executive Director of Sustainable Valley Technology Group in Southern Oregon. And I will start with a little history. We're going into our fifth year, and our vision, the vision of starting Sustainable Valley, was a business accelerator to commercialize high-tech firms, things that we thought we could mimic from Silicon Valley and Seattle, places like that. And what we found was that the greatest innovations that we saw were in these advanced agriculture, advanced forestry, food product manufacturing. Those were the best, most interesting companies that we were seeing. And so at some point, you have to say, what are our innovators who are our entrepreneurs? What are they doing, right? Well, how do we nurture and encourage those entrepreneurs to be more successful? So just to paint a picture, I also want to say that I don't envision this bill as, and I'd like to reframe a little bit on how people think about rural Oregon. Many of you are constituents in rural Oregon, and I think it's not a handout program. This is really to discover and draw out those innovations that are happening out there, that some of which we know of and some of which we don't. I'll give you a couple of examples of companies that we've been working with. One of them they're Oregon Tech students. You know, much of rural Oregon doesn't have access to a research institute, so these innovations must come from our
community colleges, our universities, what resources we do. The OSU Extensions are a big partner in what we've been trying to create as more of an infrastructure for manufacturing of some of these things. But one of these technologies, they take recycled shipping containers, they retrofit them with advanced aeroponics systems developed by NASA quite a while ago. They are 98% water efficient. These are units that can grow fruit and vegetables all year round. They grow a 640-acre farm on a one-acre footprint with 98% water efficiencies. These are amazing, world-changing technologies, and they're being developed in Klam Falls. So what I see is a $50,000 investment would get them through their entire prototype phase, and they've got angel investors, they've got SBIRs, they've got a great wealth of other things that they can use to commercialize their investment after that. But how do we find them and more like them so that we can take this natural resource economy that Oregon has and take it to really the 21st and 22nd century? How do we leapfrog ahead of some of the perception that there's no sophistication out in rural Oregon? I think that's a misconception. I think there's some amazing, brilliant advanced manufacturing people out there that with a little bit of targeted support will really create incredible results. And I also want to talk about just ag tech, because I've been very active in that space, creating a group to look at some federal opportunities that were mentioned in the Farm Bill for agricultural centers of excellence and what that might look like. And I think that we have an opportunity to not only become better and more efficient at sourcing and exporting vegetables and fruit crops. So we've got 220 specialty crops in this state, which is an incredible number. It's an incredible asset. So how can we become better at nurturing the technologies that all are starting to converge in agriculture, which are your, and there's a little list on the handout that I gave you, which is mostly for your reference later, but electric vehicles, unmanned aerial vehicles, sensor data. You know, I went to a MEMS conference, one of the largest in the country recently, and the keynote speaker from Stanford said this is the trillion sensor movement and the future of agriculture. So this is a very, very innovative space. You've got robotics and automation, GIS, mapping systems, tracking systems, some of the most advanced technologies that we're seeing are converging and being used in agriculture, and we are ahead of the curve, and I think we should invest in that and become the curve, become the leaders in this, which I think we can.
I like that that concluding comment, become the curve.
Become the curve.
Thank you for that. Any questions from Mr. Yeah, Representative Gallegos?
One short, I don't know if it's a comment or a question, but you know, we've heard, my question earlier was on the geographic spread in terms of your state review. I'm real interested, and I don't think we need to answer it here today, but I'd like to hear eventually some discussion about sort of the cultural diversity in the state and what implication that has for innovation. So that, because Oregon, particularly rural Oregon, is a particularly aging population, as well as we have a significant Latino population, certainly involved in agriculture and other things. So how are we thinking about that as part of our variables? So.
Good observation. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I think we are in a much better place as far as understanding House Bill 2434. We've got some work to do, but I think we'll be able to do it. Hopefully we'll be back to this bill, too. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2434? I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2434 and open public hearings on House Bill 2262 and House Bill 2288. Is there anyone who'd like to testify on those bills? I don't see any. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2262 and House Bill 2288. And is there anything else that needs to come before the committee today? Thank you very much. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you on Monday morning.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.
8 o'clock or
8 a.m. or 9 o'clock?
8 o'clock. 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock or
8 a.m. or 9 o'clock?